welcome to the New Flesh Podcast. My name is Brett Arnold, at Brett Redacted on Twitter. I am here yet again with Jesse Hassinger, and we are returning to the Psycho franchise, even though, for all intents and purposes, we have finished the Psycho franchise. It is done. There is a Bates Motel TV series, 5 seasons of it, to watch that we are under no obligation to do so, but I am doing so for fun. I'm enjoying it. And we are here today. This is a Patreon bonus episode that you may be hearing on the main feed. But this is a Patreon bonus episode about the 1987 made-for-TV movie that was originally filmed as a pilot for a TV series that never happened. It's called Bates Motel. Real original. It came out between, I believe, Psycho 3 and 4. So, and it just, you know, is not canon. It has, like, nothing to do with the film franchise, even though it tries to be connected to it in some way. We'll get to it shortly. Even though this is a Patreon bonus, we didn't do a main feed episode this week, so we will do a bits and pieces segment. And what's up, Jesse? How's your week? What's going on?
Oh, it's, you know, it's fine. watching in horror as the rest of the country succumbs to coronavirus. But in New York, we're doing good, right? Like, our numbers are good.
Yeah, we're thriving. I'm pretty sure our phase 3 will be delayed, it seems, maybe. The indoor dining stuff seems to be a bad idea. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, New York is still good. Somehow California really botched it. But yeah, a lot of southern states are surging right now. Yeah, oh boy, that's another horror story in itself. But for today, we're talking about Bates Motel, and I will give you a handful of bits and pieces. Did you watch any other movies this week? Are there any major releases that we missed?
I watched a bunch of horror. Actually, I finally saw St. Maud. Maybe this will be bear talking about in greater detail another time. But I watched St. Maud. I watched The Beach House, the Shudder movie that I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about
yet. Yeah, I watched that as well, and I'm not sure either. But we can.
The Beach House, I was not wildly enthusiastic about. And I also watched St. Maud and Relic, which are both horror movies coming out, kind of on the artier side, coming to maybe drive-ins, I guess. I mean, Relic is definitely going to play drive-ins. And I don't know what the plan is with St. Maud now that theater openings have kind of been pushed back again.
Yeah, and didn't they just announce that it's coming to video or something? Or was that...
Probably. Yeah, I mean, that would make sense.
I think St. Maud is probably getting a VOD release. Maybe I'm confusing that with First Cow, which I know is definitely now getting a VOD release. I guess the latest news on the theater front, which we've been keeping you posted on, is that all the slated July openings have been pushed. All the slated July releases have been pushed. I think everything is August now. And even in some, you know, in some territories, that may be not a thing that happens, depending on where the virus is at that point. So still starved for new movie content. We are. So here we are watching movies from 1987 on YouTube that, you know, our movie is a stretch for this Bates Motel thing that we're going to talk about. Let me just get right into the news so we could just get right into this movie because I'm very excited to talk about it. The most exciting news this week is that VHS, the horror franchise, is getting a reboot with VHS 94. So David Bruckner, who is supposed to be doing the Hellraiser remake and has contributed to the other VHS films, has written and developed VHS 94 and will produce the film. Filmmaking collective Radio Silence, which we've also contributed to VHS movies, will also produce. Spyguest recently confirmed that the Radio Silence filmmaker trio will helm the company Scream sequel. We know that already. Among the directors who will contribute shorts to the new anthology are Simon Barrett of Your Next and The Guest fame, Indonesian horror helmer Timo Tijajanto, who did The Night Comes for Us, which I recommended on this podcast. It's awesome. So VHS 94 will be the first in the horror series to be presented in a single fluid narrative with each section lined up. I don't love that idea. The whole you know, the whole vibe of anthology horror for me is, you know, keep them separated, much like the Offspring have told us to do. I just don't understand the insistence on horror franchises getting caught up in, like, you know, the frame story that wraps around. And that's what this sounds like to me. But we'll see. I'm still excited for it. Brad Miska and Tom Owen of BloodyDisgusting.com, actually, co-creators of the franchise, will produce the new edition. The original VHS premiered in Sundance at Sundance in 2012 and spawned two sequels and a spinoff, Siren. Oh, God, that spinoff is really bad. And there's apparently a Snapchat Snap original miniseries based on the format, but who knew that? Not me. Are you a fan of this franchise? Have you seen any of them?
No, I don't think I have.
Right on. I love it. Keep it rolling. The next bit of news is there's a Twister reboot. Have you seen Twister, Jesse?
I, of course, have seen Twister. I was young once, sure. yeah, it was like a big movie event in 1996. And I have to say, even then, I feel like I didn't remember it for longer than a few weeks after. So I am puzzled.
Oh, wow. This movie has staying power. It made a fuck ton of money back then. I think when it came out, it made something like $400 million or something worldwide. But is its staying power connected to the fact that, like, the weird soundstagey theme park ride version of it that, like, still existed at least up until a few years ago and may still exist at Universal Studios, where it was basically, like, the crazy wind effects from that movie?
I don't know. I'm not sure if I was fully aware of that. I feel like it's also, like, a big cable movie, although I can't imagine, like, the whole big thing about this movie is that it had really cool special effects. So watching it on TNT or whatever, they would play it over and over. It seems like a lot of it would be lost on there. But I believe this was also the first movie released on digital versatile disc, DVD.
Is that right?
To those of us who recall DVDs fondly. But yeah, I maybe the theme park, maybe a good, sometimes a good theme park attraction really can keep a movie, affection for a movie alive much longer than.
I've never seen Backdraft, but I've been to the Backdraft ride.
Stunt Spectacular,
whatever the fuck that was. Yeah. At the Orlando Universal, which I also did this Twister thing, which in my mind was just like a, it was like a ride. It wasn't a ride. It was more like a thing you walk through, and then it was like, well, here, there's a tornado. And then it would just be really crazy windy for a minute. There would be, like, the cow flying around somehow. That they really got a lot of, I feel like a lot of TV spots and trailers out of that cow.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Iconic imagery. Anyway, Universal Pictures is looking to reboot the way it's described, the classic tentpole of Twister.
Oh boy, that just gives me a bad kind of chill. The classic tentpole.
Yeah, Twister, 1996 blockbuster. Wasn't it directed by Jan DeBont?
Yes. It was his follow-up to Speed and his the movie he made before Speed 2 Cruise Control.
the Speed Sandwich for Jan DeBont. Twister did make $494 million at the worldwide box office. And it was, applauded for its groundbreaking special effects. Jan DuBont, director, Steven Spielberg executive produced, and in a rare occurrence, author Michael Crichton penned the script. I did not think I knew that Michael Crichton wrote Twister.
Yeah.
Plot details are vague on this latest version, but the original film starred Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt, who play storm chasers and a couple on the brink of divorce. They team up to chase tornadoes in order to deliver their advanced weather alert system that has to be placed in the path of a twister.
Yeah, I have to say, plot details are actually still pretty vague on the original, as far as I'm concerned.
Twister happens, cow hits the camera. That's all I got for that movie. It's just like, that movie is, I mean, it's perfect that there's a theme park ride for it, because that's really all it was. It was just kind of like a special effects, like, it's kind of, as you said, it's perfect that was maybe the, as you say, the first DVD, because it does seem like the thing that, if there was like a 4K UHD of it, I'd put that on to test the system. The sound and the visuals looked on it. But anyway, this reboot will be directed by Joseph Kosinski, who just did Top Gun Maverick is that a Universal picture?
I think it's Paramount.
I think you're right, it is Paramount. But Joseph Kosinski just did Top Gun for Paramount, and I believe previously He did something that I liked. He did Only the Brave, which I thought was like very underrated and good. The firefighter movie.
Oh yeah, it was a pretty well done movie. He also made Oblivion with our man Tom Cruise.
Maybe one of like three Tom Cruise movies I haven't seen is Oblivion.
Oh, it's not great, but it's a pretty good looking movie. Just like the same way that Tron Legacy, maybe not a great movie, but a very good looking movie.
Yes, also a Joseph Kaczynski joint. So Twister will be produced by Frank Marshall, and the studio is currently meeting with writers to pen the script. The script for this must be like 8 pages, and a lot of it is just like whooshing sounds. But yeah, that's not super horror news, but it's interesting nonetheless. I'm sure a lot of horror fans love that movie or are nostalgic for it at the very least. So the writer of Behind the Mask, the Rise of Leslie Vernon classic horror flick, and the director of Tucker and Dale versus Evil are joining forces for Netflix, The Hills Have Eyes for You, a horror romantic comedy. So the Eli Craig of Tucker and Dale is directing, and Dan Farrow will produce, and Andrew Farrow will executive produce. Stephanie Davis will serve as co-producer. This is a unique underdog love story with genre-bending scares and a lot of laughs. I think I'll be in my element for this one. Dan Farrow called it a fresh and fun love story set against the backdrop of an elevated horror comedy. There's not a lot of details on that, but I'm a big fan of Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, and I like Behind the Mask as well. So all four Netflix putting out that content. Speaking of Netflix, they're putting out Ju-on: The Grudge, a TV series, on Netflix as like an original series on, I believe, the July 3rd, whenever that is, maybe this weekend. I've heard it's very gory and interesting. So put that on your radar. If you're a fan of Ju-on or The Grudge, this is the original Grudge in its original language. It's a Japanese series. And the 3-hour director's cut of Mike Flanagan's Dr. Sleep, which I reviewed on, I believe, a bonus episode, or maybe it was a Patreon behind the paywall episode. That movie is now available on HBO Max, which I've been watching because Search Party Season 3 was on it. And so I'm loving HBO Max because they have one of my favorite shows on it. And Bruce Campbell says the new Evil Dead movie is titled Evil Dead Rise. I think I said that already. But he doesn't think it'll happen until 2021. He said it's a whole new ball game, no more Cabin in the Woods. Very exciting stuff for Evil Dead fans. Is there any other movies you want to mention before we dive into Bates Motel?
I'm trying to remember if there were any. I'm actually just curious if you watched Irresistible, the Jon Stewart film.
I haven't yet, but it's on my list.
I haven't yet either. I was just hoping to.
It just doesn't sound appealing in any way, shape, or form.
It does not. That is true. But I did watch Eurovision, the Netflix original, and it's not a horror movie in any way, but it's pretty funny. I like Will Ferrell, and I feel like he hasn't made a good broad comedy in like a while, and this one's pretty good.
I was mad at Eurovision because its insistence on the movie being like a romance between Rachel McAdams and Will Ferrell. I just was so annoyed by that because it's not only that was like a feature of it, it's that it would like go on like these long sections about it as if like I really care that much about the story. Because like I thought the music and the spectacle stuff was all really good, and I just was really bored in long stretches. And like for a 2-hour movie, like you could have cut some shit out. I don't know.
Yeah. I was harsher
on it than most. I know everyone's like, it's, you know, we haven't been seeing movies, so this one is pretty good.
There's the Netflix curve of like, wow, this is pretty good for a Netflix movie.
Oh, for sure. No, I definitely enjoyed watching it, but I think it was like an hour in, just like there was like this 20-minute lull of plotting where I'm like, I just don't care. I just don't care at all. But I really like the open. Volcano Man is a great song. Double Trouble's been stuck in my head all fucking week. Like, you can't
McAdams is so good. I think the reason I didn't bristle too much at the romance, even though it is a pretty typical, like, a beautiful woman being forced to hold a torch for an older and goofier man, is that McAdams is really convincing in this movie. She's,
Sigrid!
It's a skillful performance, I find. Like, she brings a lot of sincerity to it while still being very funny, so that sort of made me feel a little more,
I'm a big fan.
Forgiving. She's great.
She's great in Game Night. It's so funny. Did you have that same thought that she, like, does the same joke she does in Game Night where someone dies and she's like, oh no! Like, that same gag happens in both movies. Uh-huh. It's so strange. But yeah, I did not enjoy Eurovision, but it wasn't my favorite. I also rewatched Green Room with some friends who were visiting because I had never seen it, and that's always a fun movie to show people. I went and saw Gladiator at the Skyline Drive-In.
Yeah, that's in my neighborhood. I that's cool. How did that work? I'm very interested now. What kind of an experience was this?
It was a good experience. It was like, I mean, it's expensive for a drive-in. I believe it's like $55 a car, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very expensive.
It's very expensive, especially when you consider it is a movie projected from clearly a Blu-ray disc onto the side of not even a building, but like a pillar. Like it's really minimal, and they're really classic New York milking of, you know, everyone's willingness to pay that price. Uh-huh. And the view of the skyline is fucking incredible. So like you get, kind of paying to be there. And I get the vibe. I enjoyed it. And it's been a running joke with my old roommate that he always is a big fan of this movie and I never liked it. So it's just been a running joke. Every year he gets me some Gladiator related birthday gift. Like he got me like the Region 2 Blu-ray for some reason because it had like some extended shit on it. He got me a signed Russell Crowe headshot from the movie. Like just so much ridiculous shit. So when we saw that it was playing, when he lives in Long Island City still, right over the bridge from them, I was like, okay, we got to go see fucking Gladiator on the water there. So, you know, it was fun and I had a good time. And we brought my roommate's dog and like the dog was great. And it was just like you could sit outside in your car on a blanket. There's enough room. You could have a couple chairs. There was a single food truck there, which is a huge missed opportunity. There should be so many because there was one and it was like it was the most. It was like they had like cannolis. It was like a very specific food truck. But it was overall, I would say definitely do it if you're interested, if there's a movie you want to see. But, I mean, my first thing, I was like, I'll bet you guys $100 that this is a Blu-ray disc. Like, there's no... And then, of course, like, it is because they kept the captions on, which I'm happy with. But it just was like, you know, I get the same level of presentation in my basement, and I'm not watching it getting bitten by bugs or in my car. Right. So, it's
like, it sounds very much of the, like, I would say the lower end in terms of presentation, like, you know, I love the Northside Festival when they did it, but like their, the summer screen, I guess is that what it is. Which is by the Northside people, summer screen in McCarran Park would be very clearly a Blu-ray or worse, on a sheet.
I mean, that makes, yes. And that makes sense to me. Like they're not going to, I know how much like a DCP projector costs, it's like $80,000. Sure. They're not going to do it for like an event like that. But if you're getting $55 a car showing movies, like, I don't know, are they doing it under the table? When you're doing it by Blu-ray, I'm sure you still have to get sanctioned to do it, but it's clear. It's definitely a lot cheaper and they still have to pay for the rights. But If they're trying to make it a permanent thing, that's like, this is a Skyline Drive in New York, it's like a thing that people like to do, just invest a little more in it. And like, I would totally go if it was like top of the line DCP projection. Because like,
I feel like I have no idea what the land situation is, but I feel like somewhere out in Queens, there must be enough land to do probably a small but still like genuine drive-in that like is like an actual drive-in that's not like if you can do like a kind of smaller version in Greenpoint, I feel like you should be able to do like a kind of do it upright in Queens, and I feel like the time has come. They need to do a drive-in now.
Yeah, the Greenpoint one is pretty small in terms of like how many cars can fit in there. But it's also just like the vibe is like this is a construction site. Like it's just like there's constant construction happening around, not like at the moment, like while you're watching the movie, but like there's just like equipment everywhere. And it just seems like at the end of the day, like, all right, let's let people like hang out here while we're done with our work at the construction site. Mixed feelings about it. I probably won't do it again because I have a projector in my basement and it is much more of an enjoyable experience and I can have friends over and do that whole thing. But if you're starved for seeing a movie in public and you want a cannoli, definitely, definitely go. I mean, you can bring your own booze and you can walk up, you know, it's right by Pauly G's Pizza. You can walk up with a fucking pizza. It doesn't matter. So like, that's cool. But you definitely, you know, you're paying $55. So
yeah.
I just expect a little more, but I'm...
That's the classic New York experience.
Yeah, it really is.
Getting the shakedown.
Yeah, exactly true. Exactly right. All right, let's move on to, oh God, Bates Motel 1987. This is easily the most bizarre entry in this franchise, and maybe in any of horror franchise I've ever seen. I was just like mildly like thought this was interesting, even though I knew it was bad the whole time. But then it like takes on a whole nother level in the third act. Not even the third act, like the last 10 minutes, it just like goes bananas. And I kind of admire its batshittedness. What do you think of Bates Motel 1987?
You know, it's so interesting to kind of, my sort of comparison point for this was Psycho 4, because they both sort of follow Psycho 3 in very different directions. I mean, just chronologically, obviously, this one's not trying to like sequelize Psycho 3, but they both follow, they're both TV movies that kind of follow Psycho 3, you know, and both feel, you know, certainly inessential compared to, even if you really love Psycho, you might want to see 2 and 3, and then after that you probably don't need to check out either of these things. And obviously it's much more like a TV movie than Psycho 4, which for all its other faults is like pretty much shot like a real movie, and you know, it looks like a real movie that like happened to be on cable, direct to cable.
It was shot like, wide, yes.
Yeah, yeah. This like looks like, you know, I don't know if it was shot on video or film, but it was definitely, it's hard to tell on YouTube.
Definitely 4:3. Yes.
But it's, you know, it's shot like a TV show / TV movie. That said, I had a kind of peculiar affection for it, perhaps more so than Psycho 4, because it doesn't really ruin anything. I mean, Psycho 4 doesn't ruin anything, but like there are cool ideas in Psycho 4 that I think are not borne out by the movie itself, and are very, as such, disappointing. There was no disappointment for me watching Bates Motel. It is really nutty, and it has a weird kind of, it's, you know, kind of gives you an hour of pilot background material, and then kind of gives you a sample episode in the back, you know, in the last half an hour. And neither of those things are very good. But I kind of enjoyed the weirdness of it as kind of a footnote to the Psycho series. I wouldn't really recommend checking it out. It's kind of bad, but but I, you know, I thought it was sort of, I was maybe a little less irritated by it than I was watching the Psycho 4. Maybe
that's
because
funny.
Like, yeah, there's no, if it didn't feel like Anthony Perkins was there doing, you know, having his effort go to waste the way I did with the Psycho 4.
Well, I guess that's fair. I just couldn't believe, like, the retcon that they try to pull at the beginning of this movie. Like, the way it opens with Norman Bates being brought to justice and a very over-the-top newscaster doing the announcing. I almost wish the whole movie just was this guy explaining what was happening. He was like, "So ends the most terrible and bizarre chapter in the history of this picture book town. Murderer, victim, you decide." And then he's just like narrating as like B-roll footage is rolling, and he's like, "This is the knife sharpening store where Norman's mother would take young Norman to sharpen his knives." And then it goes, "Oh yes, and here's the hotel he worked at after school."
They give an origin to his hotel management skills.
I know, which in the first movie was explained away by him saying, you know, "Oh, my mom got interested with this guy who convinced her to build this hotel, and then the fucking highway got built and ruined it, so it was, like, a bad idea." So there was definitely decidedly no backstory of Norman working at a hotel and, like, showing an interest in hotel management as this movie, as this movie's newscaster decides.
Well, and there's kind of a weird... The whole thing has kind of takes on a weird kind of sentimental quality that at first I thought was maybe supposed to be sort of darkly funny, and then turns out to be not.
Just poorly,
I mean,
sort
of funny, but it's not, I don't think it's intentionally darkly funny. Where this sort of protege of Norman's, who he meets while in the psych ward for so many years, played by Bud Cort from Harold and Maude.
Yes.
And
from, like, My Fucking Nightmares. He's so creepy looking. I'm sorry.
Oh, and he's also, I think from fondly, is the two bookends that are kind of right in the opposite ends of this. You know, he's Harold and Maude, and he's kind of a cute kid in that.
Yes.
And then he's he's the Bond Company stooge, as Steve Zissou calls him in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
That's right.
I think it probably cast to pay tribute to Hal Ashby, who is obviously an influence on Wes Anderson. So he's a young kid who meets Norman Bates in the psych ward, and then most of the movie is about him, you know, being grown up and being let out and being left the Bates Motel and wanting to do right by Norman Bates.
Who's in an urn that he's carrying around the entire time.
And the whole business of Bates having a motel is treated with such weird, like, sweet but kind of sickly sweet and dumb sensitivity. Like, this kid, who is sort of mentored by Norman, the murderer, Norman, and this kid is also in the psych ward for being kind of a murderer, you know, kind of a head case murderer.
Wait, let me describe this. Yeah. The way they describe it, they say this kid was abused by his father, who owned a dry cleaner and used to put him in the dryer. And then they said one day he got sick of it and then dry cleaned his father.
Yeah. The psychology of this movie is very vocation based. It's like everybody's weird little hang-ups come from their parents' professions and what kind of store they owned or what kind of business they owned. Very strange. So he being, I guess, and then that carries over to the weird thing of the whole weird premise of it is that this kid grows up, and Norman Bates dies, leaves the motel to him.
He's essentially Norman Bates' son, for like all intents and purposes. This guy was raised by Norman Bates.
Yeah. Without no one intervened in the psych ward.
It was just a normal father-son. Yeah. They played catch and stuff.
Yeah. There's all these photos of them together. Yeah. And then he's going to now run the motel and try to do right by Norman. The whole movie kind of reorients Norman Bates to be obsessed with hotels in a way that I don't think is borne out by the original text. And so his drive, this kid does not know dick about managing anything. But his drive in the movie/show is that he really wants to make a go of being a good motel manager.
I'm gonna start crying because I'm cracking up at the idea that when he at like so much of the beginning of this movie, like the first 10 minutes, is him just trying to find the motel. He can't find it. Yeah. And he's just asking people.
In retrospect, that's funny. I think the movie is so strange that I didn't notice right away how much time. But that's true.
He keeps There's asking a lot people, of and they all every person like says, "I just moved here. I don't know."
it's asking insane. Strangers for directions. It's a very in this aired on television as something to really hook you into the world of the show. and you're meeting this kid, and
struck by how strange it is. It's just Bud Cort walking around with like a piece of paper that Norman left him that says like take this bus very vaguely. And then he gets off the bus and he asks every person he sees, have you heard of the Bates Motel? And most of them haven't, but eventually one person has, and then he is taken there, and thank God he found that guy, because what's the rest of this movie if that doesn't happen? It's like three hours.
Then it's a multi-season arc where he's looking for the hotel.
He dies of starvation. He just has no survival skills because he's been in a mental hospital his whole life. Oh my God. But to me, this whole movie is just bizarre because the premise to me, like I know you said you were thinking three and four because this movie just came at that time. To me, I just kept thinking of Psycho 2 because the premise is essentially the same. Except instead of Norman being out of prison or out of the mental ward and being brought back, except now it's just a proto, like a fake Norman Bates. It's just like a person with an adjacent relationship to Norman Bates. Yeah. Instead of Norman, it's
we get someone
Alex.
Who's like Norman Bates, but less charismatic.
Yeah, but somehow he looks like he, I don't know, Bud Cort in this movie looks like he like belongs in the Twin Peaks like lodge. He just is very scary looking to me.
It's interesting. They don't as much as he looks kind of uncomfortable and nebbishy in a way that I feel like is compatible with Norman and while still bringing different energy to it. They don't really lean into the creepiness of it. They sort of
he's just like nice and bumbly.
His social ineptitude is sort of like is like fodder for kind of zaniness.
Yeah, it's such a strange thing. I also just remembered that, like, the reason that the people with the mental ward put Alex with Norman is because, not only because they have a similar history or whatever, but Alex was, like, taxidermying a bird, and he named it Jack. And they're like, you need someone to talk to who knows an awful lot about how to make Jack stay healthy, your taxidermied bird. So, like, because this kid's in the taxidermy, they're like, hey, Norman, talk to this kid. And then, lo and behold, it ends with him dying off screen and this kid inheriting Bates Motel. And then the rest of this movie, I think you accurately described it as like a Scooby-Doo arc. It's definitely like a Scooby-Doo-esque plot. And then it just goes, which I think you started to describe as well. What I could only describe is like what the pitch must have been for like what the show is, which is like, well, in addition to the weird Norman stuff, we could also just do like a look in at each of the guests in the hotel and like
people drift into this motel for different reasons and their stories will have different kind of vaguely horror or very vaguely spooky angles, and we'll explore that. Like, I don't even know if this show was supposed to be an hour or half an hour.
No idea. But clearly that's what they were going for. And then the one they chose to do, the episode, so to speak, that they put as their example of what the show could be, I could see why they passed. It was very fucking bizarre. We'll talk about that in a minute. I was struck by something.
When he arrives at the hotel and starts a motel, excuse me, and stays at, and also stays at the old Bates place, he meets a drifter played by Lori Petty.
Yes, a drifter played by Lori Petty, and she is dressed in a full like chicken mascot outfit when we see her, and it's actually really. That's that shot of like the chicken before it's revealed to be like a chicken outfit, and you just see like the vague shadowy outline of it. Actually, very scary.
That's creepy. Yeah,
because like you don't see that often. I just thought that was a great image.
Yeah, no, it is a cool, weird image. And she's wearing a chicken mascot because she's like does she work for? Is it a restaurant or is it just like a store or something?
Well, I think it's the restaurant because it's the same one I think that he goes to, right? And is like, he asks the drive through how to get to the Bates Motel.
Oh, right, right. right. In the long direction asking sequence that is included.
Yeah, he goes to he walks up to the chicken drive through and it's like, can I help you? And he's like, yes, where's the Bates Motel? And they're like, crispy or original? And he says crispy, and he just keeps answering until at the end he goes, no, you misunderstand. I'm looking for the Bates Motel. And then she goes, I'm sorry, I just moved here. And then she just takes the next person's order. It is an astonishing sequence.
Yes.
So what were we talking about? I called Lori Petty is, I could only describe her as like an Ellen DeGeneres type. In this role, like, it just felt like, I mean, I don't know if Ellen was in vogue at this point in time. I don't even think she was.
I think she was doing stand-up, I think, but would not have been.
That's right.
It was not as well known as.
But Lori Petty did, God, all this stuff she did was after this. Like, she's in Point Break in the 90s and Free Willy and Tank Girl.
The thing I know her really well from is A League of Their Own from 92, which is about 5 years after this. And I was struck by how in this she has similar mannerisms, and like, A League of Their Own, she's like playing kind of the archetypal kid sister to Gina Davis's character, and in this she has real kid sister energy too. In both of them, there's kind of a weird sense of like, are you actually 15? Because like her mannerisms are very like, you know, teenage girl with moxie, but her sort of, you know, the way she carries herself, she feels like more like an adult. It's just a bizarre. It's a bizarre.
I didn't catch that she was supposed to be so young. It's so weird.
Oh, I don't know if she was actually. That's the thing. It's impossible. I could not tell you how old this character was supposed to be.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Between 15 and 35, I'll say.
And she's got, like, I mean, basically this other dude is trying to tell him how to, like, the local banker is trying to tell him how to assist in making the place. He wants to turn it into, like, a sleazy motel with, like, vibrating beds and stuff. And the runaway drifter who's squatting is like, no, we're gonna turn this place to make it nice. We're not gonna let them.
It's gonna be a respectable type joint. Yeah, she volunteers to be the cook at the cafe that Alex wants to open adjacent to the motel, because why not add a cafe to this famous murder site?
Yeah, people want a cafe, obviously. Yeah. And this is maybe about the point where the banker hires like a construction team to do some stuff, and like they're there, and they the guy operating the crane or whatever you want to call it gets struck by lightning, or no, he gets, what do you call it, electrocuted, because yes, they're digging and they happen upon wiring or whatever, but they also happen upon the corpse of Norman's mother.
Yeah, that was confusing, right? Because like, yes. If this movie sort of picks up from Psycho and doesn't really say anything one way or the other about Psycho 2 or 3, and even if it did, we last leave that corpse fully exhumed, because it was never buried, in the Bates home.
Right.
And that is discovered when Norman is arrested, and presumably... Yeah, so, but what this presupposes is that someone else, or Norman, or so, I don't know, someone went and buried her deep, deep under the motel sometime after Norman had been arrested, which is, I get it's like a minor issue, but it for the very low scare that it provides in terms of like, oh, there's a corpse we dug up, spooky, it's confusing more than anything, because that corpse is very famously not buried. It's like one of the most famous not buried corpse in movie history, I would say, and yet they do find it many feet underground of the Bates Motel, which had me wondering who was to have buried it so many years ago.
Yeah, it's very strange. And then this movie does this thing where it plays with the idea of, is Norman's mother around, or is like, are we seeing like some sort of ghosty thing? But let me say this right off the bat, that it is clear on its fucking face, like clearer than any cartoon episode of Scooby-Doo when you know who the villain's going to be at the end when they rip the mask off. It is clear that the person terrorizing Alex at the Bates Motel is just the local banker who's trying to get his way and scare Alex off the valuable property that Norman bestowed upon him. And like, so when that, sorry, spoiler alert, when that moment happens at the end, it is such like an anticlimactic thing that it truly, it plays like an episode of Scooby-Doo. I can't describe any other way.
And because you're watching like a live action movie supposedly made for adults, it's one of those things where the twist is so non-twisty that it becomes confusing. I thought for sure we were being set up to look at him as a red herring and then have it turn out to be the Lori Petty character, who's kind of inexplicably attached to Alex, right. Sort of socially she's kind of socially maladjusted, but he's like far more socially maladjusted. She just sort of is, you know, mouthy and full of moxie and like perhaps a little strange, but he's genuinely does not know how to interact with people. So I thought for sure she's obsessed with him for some reason, and that would maybe she's going to be turn out to be related to someone or whatever, you know, some kind of dumb twist. But it does, that's not the case. She's just truly very loyal to these protege of Norman Bates, and it was the banker who kind of seems like a jerk the whole time and turns out to be trying to scare them away for money. Just like, yeah, it's so you're watching it going like, oh wait, that's really it. It's very confusing. There aren't even I'm reminded a little bit of a novelist I love, Amy Bloom, talked about how she tried to make one of her novels, her first novel, I think she tried to write it as a mystery, and she showed it to her agent, and her agent was like, you know, the thing about mysteries is they have to have more than one suspect. And I felt like about this too. I mean, there are two in this, but it's a similar thing where it's like, there are not even enough characters in this for you to wonder, oh, who might be pretending to be Norma Bates, or maybe it's not that at all. The movie makes no attempt to generate actual mystery over it, so you're just kind of running out the clock on that storyline.
Totally. And speaking of new characters, right after they find Norman's mom's corpse, we hear the story of Jake Bates, a new character, Norman's father. The story we get about Jake Bates is Jake was always down at the hotel making sure the customers were satisfied. More of the pretty looking ones. AKA, they did it like the most TV version way of saying Jake was cheating on Norma's Norma by just saying that in that way. It was very silly. But basically, Jake was cheating at the hotel, and then one day he vanished, and then she went bananas. She was wearing a black dress in mourning and staring at the vacancy sign, waiting for him to return, but he never did. And then, like, right after they give you that explanation, another corpse turns up, and he's wearing a ring that says JB on it. And, like, every line of dialogue, like, is keyed into, in case you miss, in case you're, like, not watching the screen. It's like, oh, he's wearing a ring that says JB. Those are his initials. It's like, it's very stupid. But that whole thing, I don't even like get what the point of it is. Like,
no, it's kind of taking away time where you should be kind of figuring out what's interesting about Alex and his predicament. And you're sort of continuing to futz around with Bates' backstory that is worse than the backstory that we've been provided in other Psycho movies.
Totally worse. Also, this movie just entirely drops Alex for a long while at the end. It's like it's another movie. As we mentioned, it just like shifts to... Basically, they get their first guest. It's this woman named Sally, I think. Or doesn't she say her name is something different? She says her name is Barbara or something. She's she says her name is Barbara. And she shows up and she's a writer, and she's there by herself, but, like, soon after she gets there, a bunch of teenage kids show up, and, like, they look like they stepped straight out of the 1950s and 60s, and it's, like, a very strange scene, but, like, they're all partying, and one of the students walks into Barbara's room by mistake. It ends up being, like, a fortuitous mistake, because Barbara was, like, sitting there contemplating suicide. So then this girl who, like, stumbled into her room with the wrong key or whatever said, wow, this key actually ended up working. She convinces Barbara to come, like, hang out and party with them. And she resists at first, but finally gives in and ends up, like, dancing with a nice young man who turns out to be Jason Bateman, who, like, is so young it's unrecognizable. Like, it took me the whole scene before I was like, oh, that is Jason Bateman.
Yeah, oh, the whole movie, I saw his name in the credits and I still didn't know it was him.
Oh, that's so funny.
Because I think in a daze, this movie put me in a kind of confused state.
Oh, for sure.
It's an uncharacteristically brooding role for Jason Bateman, who I usually think of as being very verbal.
Yes, and he's just sitting there being sad. And
yeah.
And the answer to this, why he's sad, is coming. So it is very bizarrely revealed that Barbara's real name is actually Sally, and that the teenage girl she's seeing is her younger self, but not from reality, from an alternate dimension in which she did take her own life and is now trapped on the other side along with Jason Bateman's character and, like, a group of other teenagers who all committed suicide, who we get introductions to each and every one. They're, like, just, like, a little scene where it's, like, hi, I'm this person, and I killed myself.
And, like, yeah, reciting the dates that they killed themselves. And they are all, like, it's funny, I'm not sure what the purpose of this is, but they're all... I mean, I guess for the kind of to square with the costumes and art direction, but they've all, I mean, this is contemporary when this movie's happening. It is supposed to be actually in the 80s.
Right.
But these are all these teenagers, you know, rattling off the dates in the 50s and 60s when they killed themselves, unconcerned with teenage suicide past 1963 or so, for some reason. These baby boomers, they just don't care.
It's not even like they tie it to, like, being like, these are, like, the ghosts who killed themselves here or something. It's just, like, completely out of left field.
It's also confusing because a group of teenagers comes, and it's like, it's this also saves the motel, essentially.
Yeah, so aren't, right? Like, am I crazy? Or wasn't there a sequence with, like, them interacting with Alex and stuff? Or Yes.
A bunch of them come, and he's delighted to find out the room, that there's actually the vacancy sign turns to the no vacancy sign.
So what the fuck, man?
And I think the idea is supposed to be that there's a group of teenagers, and within this group, and therefore hard to, you know, pick out as being a ghost, are some ghosts.
That's fucking insane.
But what I couldn't stop thinking is this poor dumb bastard Alex is so inexperienced at running a motel that he winds up booking all his rooms for ghosts who can't pay. Because it weirdly parallels the teenagers who come to the motel in, now I don't remember if it was Psycho 2 or 3. I think it's 3, right?
I think it's 3.
For like, they show up for like a football game out of town or whatever. It's kind of that vibe, except a little more retro. And yeah, I think we're meant to think that, okay, that some of them were genuine teenagers, but it's very confusing. And you are fearful for the financial state of the motel because Alex does not have his shit together. And it's not outside the realm of possibility that he would accidentally rent all of his rooms to ghosts and receive no money for it. But it apparently like that's not the problem.
Yeah, it just seems like the movie, it's like when the pilot didn't get picked up, it's like they told the writers, like, well, we'll just turn it into a PSA against suicide or something. Like, it doesn't, I would love to know the series of incidents that led to this scene being added, because it doesn't seem to make any fucking sense in context with any of anything else. And it just, that's the only thing I could think of. It truly is so not like in the same universe as the rest of the movie.
Well, I do think it's very much was supposed to serve as an example. And this is, you're right. I think you're right. That's why it probably didn't get picked up. It was supposed to be like, and when the, now that the motel is up and running, you'll see fascinating stories like this one. And then their example is like, a lady wants to kill herself, and then a ghost of herself from another dimension tells her not to, and she sort of acquiesces, and that's that. And because it is, I think if you cut this amount in half, I think that storyline does begin around what have been the second hour of the broadcast. Probably around the 45-minute mark of the movie, which is about 90-something minutes. So I do think the idea was like, oh, the episodes will be like this. And I can see why someone would say, this is not a 45-minute episode of television. Like, this is not – there's not enough here, guys. Like, it's – there's nothing that especially scary happens in it. You don't really learn that much about any of these characters. And then, you know, it's sort of over in a flash. So
It's like I described it as like a suicidal Christmas carol. It's like this woman just gets to see like an alternate version of life, but like not really. Just like a bunch of dead teens talk to her for a second. It's super weird.
Yeah.
Can't describe. And then, so there's that weird pivot that feels like a PSA. And then the movie ends. It cuts back to Alex's story as if, like, because it's been like 20 minutes. You probably forgot this movie's about this guy named Alex. And then it cuts to Alex, who then unmasks the banker. And we get that plot point confirmed that he's just trying to scare him away. And then ends up like forced to help renovate the motel or face prison for fraud. And then the movie ends with like a breaking of the fourth wall and like Bud Cort looking at the camera saying to the audience, like, if you ever need a room, come by. I can't say for sure what you'll find, but it is what makes the world go around. And it's like, what? None of this makes sense. Is that even a phrase?
It was not. No one who saw this was enticed to imagine the further guests that would be dropping by the Bates Motel in the future. But I do kind of like, I do kind of enjoy the kind of alternate history idea of like, okay, so in this timeline, this like this kind of wormy guy takes over the Bates Motel, and I guess he becomes something positive. He's not a murderer. He's someone who actually seems like he's been rehabilitated from his violent past, and he is able to start a business with a confusing semi-platonic relationship with a drifter played by Lori Petty.
Future Tank Girl. The weirdest thing about this movie and the scariest, spookiest thing is that Jason Bateman's character, who commits suicide, his name is literally Tony Scotty. It's Tony Scott with an I at the end.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what, that doesn't mean anything. Like, I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything, but Tony Scott famously committed suicide many years after this movie.
This one came out right after Top Gun when he was on top of the world. But it's also, I kind of assumed he was named Tony after Tony Perkins, although Anthony Perkins sometimes goes by Tony. Although that's weird because it's not as if Perkins was dead at this point. He was still alive. Yeah.
Maybe they were just a fan of Top Gun. Truly, yeah. I don't know.
They're just fucking owned. Bateman is also has very a name that's very close to Bates, but that's neither here nor there.
Neither here nor there. This movie was actually put out on DVD in 2013 as part of Universal's Vault series, and it was exclusively available on Amazon.com. And Universal also re-released the movie on DVD along with Psycho 2, 3, and 4 in part of a four-movie midnight pack that did not include the original Psycho.
Well,
I love those cases. There are many Child's Play cases that I think, because of rights issues, I think the first one's MGM and the rest Universal or something.
Uh-huh.
I have, like, multiple Child's Play sets that just don't have the first movie in it. Really good stuff.
You've seen it. You'll catch up. That seems to be the... I mean, it's available, we should mention it's available on YouTube for anyone to watch right now.
Yeah, I guess we should mention that, even though I don't really, I don't want to put that burden on anybody.
I will say, this is only tangentially related, but if you're looking for another late 80s curiosity that's Psycho adjacent, the 1988 film Lucky Stiff is also on YouTube. It's an obscurity that's directed by Anthony Perkins that I did go and watch. It's a zany comedy about a family trying to scam this guy, this portly gentleman, into marrying Donna Dixon from Spies Like Us, so that they may eat him. And the main actor is Joe Alasky, who was a voiceover artist who played Plucky Duck and also some of the actual Looney Tunes, in addition to the Tiny Toon character Plucky Duck.
Oh my God.
You could kind of hear a little bit of note of Plucky Duck. He doesn't have the duck lisp kind of speech impediment thing that Daffy Duck and Plucky Duck traditionally have, but you can hear the Plucky Duck tone in the back of his voice. It's written by Pat Proft, who is a gagsmith for Zucker, Abrams, and Zucker, and directed some of his own crappier spoof movies. And it's kind of fun. It's not very good either, but in terms of like a Psycho-adjacent, free on YouTube curiosity, I would go with the Anthony Perkins film that did not do well. It's very silly, but it has some laughs in it. I don't know. It's kind of enjoyable to watch this like sort of wiseacre voiceover artist who doesn't really look like a Hollywood leading man doing shtick under the direction of the inimitable Anthony Perkins. And I kind of like that it has a ghoulish. It's kind of a more fun. I thought of it during this movie because Bates Motel does have a lot of sitcom zaniness to it when they're setting up the kind of pilot aspects of this, when they're doing stuff with like Alex and the Lori Petty character. There's a lot of like, oh, Alex doesn't know what he's doing. Lori Petty's character is very brash, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's not very funny. I did sort of enjoy the farcical silliness of Lucky Stiff when I in my unexpected trawling YouTube for weird psycho things.
Hell yeah. So you recommend Lucky Stiff over the Bud Cort montage where he tries to find the Bates Motel?
I do. It doesn't have anything as accidentally funny as a big chunk of the movie being a guy fruitlessly asking for directions, but it has some actual laughs there.
I don't know why that's the funniest thing I've ever seen, but it is. It truly is the best. I think we've spent enough time talking about Bates Motel. This is supposed to be a bonus episode. It's almost a goddamn hour. So we will be back. I don't want to put a date on it because I've already blown all the dates I said we would do for the other stuff. But we're going to do Jaws hopefully in time for the weekend. I don't know what Jesse's schedule is like, but we're going to talk about it in just a second. And we'll be back with the Jaws franchise soon. Thanks for listening.
It's a bizarre.